You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Micah is one of what's called the minor prophets, and not because he's less important, but simply because his is one of a dozen shorter books from prophets who were not Isaiah or Jeremiah. Much of what we know today as Micah was probably written 800 years before Jesus' life. Judean politics, society, and worship had slid into an unjust arrangement that favored the rich. They lorded their privilege over the poor in ostentatious worship and behavior. So, Micah is basically saying to the privileged, cut it out, or else. Overall, his whole prophecy rocks back and forth between judgment and hope, judgment and hope. And the passage we hear today has a little bit of both. The last few lines are not only sentiments that many people point to as a favorite Bible verse, but also could be said to be a summary of the whole of Judeo-Christianity.
Our words of wisdom are from Micah, chapter 6, verses 6 through 8.
With what shall I come before the Lord, and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old?
Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?
God has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
If you're honest, I bet you $100 that you're more likely to be able to quote a broke, drunk elementary school dropout than anything your Sunday school teacher ever taught you. Who am I talking about? Born in 1886 to a poor family, he lived with his eight brothers and sisters in the urban squalor of a basement apartment in Covington, Kentucky. He dropped out of school in the fourth grade to find work, but couldn't find a job. When he was just 14, he moved to Chicago to take a job in a print shop that his brother-in-law had found for him. By the time he was 21, he'd saved $15, enough that he felt he could propose to his childhood sweetheart, which he did by postcard. Working as a typesetter, he pursued his two greatest passions on the side, songwriting and drinking. Throughout the 1920s, he drifted along the vaudeville circuit in a drunken stupor, making pennies per song. But in 1934, in the depths of the Depression, a bandleader heard one of his songs that struck him as having some promise. The next month, a singer by the name of Eddie Cantor recorded what I'm pretty sure are the words written across your memory more indelibly than any Sunday school lesson. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. And who do we have to thank for those lines? Tin Pan Alley songwriter Haven Gillespie, who, despite having only a fourth grade education and struggling with alcoholism his whole life, has had an outsized impact on our whole cultural psyche for nearly 100 years now. In fact, as far as people who pay attention to this kind of stuff can figure, it looks like the whole iconic notion of Santa's naughty and nice list actually sprang from the imagination of Haven Gillespie. Before 1934, Santa hadn't ever thought about making a list or checking it twice. Santa spying on children to find out who's naughty or nice is all Haven. Of course, the idea of Santa rewarding children for good behavior goes way back to European folk stories, but it took Haven to turn it into, let's be honest, the kind of creepy sentiments of, he knows when you've been sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows when you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Yikes. How much of this is harmless folklore, helpful to weary parents, and how much of it is Haven working out his guilt and struggles with drinking? I don't know, but the concept of rewarding the good and punishing the bad is a common theme across our culture and many religions. After all, the promise of heaven and threats of hell are the only reason a lot of people are even Christian at all. And up until recently, it was all pretty simple. Good deeds are rewarded, and bad behavior is punished. In fact, the church my grandmother grew up in, Christianity was primarily just do's and don'ts. Don't drink, dance, smoke, play cards, cuss, lust, steal, sleep in on Sundays, or be a Democrat. Do, pray, praise, serve, go to church often, give money to the church often, be faithful in marriage, read the Bible, and evangelize. And that all seems almost quaint anymore, doesn't it? After this last presidential campaign, none of that seems to even matter much. People used to be able to tell their kids that if they worked hard and followed the rules and were a good person, they might grow up to be president someday. But that all seems to be a bit of a stretch when you've got an incoming president who makes the naughty list seem naively old-fashioned. So where does that leave us as followers of Jesus? It's not a simple answer. The do's and don'ts are still alive and well, but now they've been complicated by the culture wars. Don't be gay, transgender, or in a same-sex marriage. Don't try to access reproductive health or want your kids to be safe from guns in schools. Don't teach about minority experiences like slavery, Jim Crow, or the Holocaust. And don't be a Democrat. Oh, that's always the same. Do put the Ten Commandments up in public school classrooms. Ban books that allude to any kind of sexuality. Discriminate against ideas and people that make you uncomfortable. Promote Christianity over other religions. Bully minorities. Our own denomination has been split up over some people's insistence that when it comes to sexual orientation and gender identity, God has definitely got a naughty and nice list. The new Global Methodist Church believes that being anything other than heterosexual is not their idea of good. I have to remind them that arguments about who's good and who's bad is exactly how the Pharisees tried to discredit Jesus. That's how the Anglicans dealt with our founder, John Wesley, who broke rule after rule of the church. We Methodists are incorrigible. Over the years, we've fought and split up over slavery, child labor, unions, woman's suffrage, and civil rights, not to mention countless theological obscurities, and it always seems to come down to different ideas of who's being naughty and who's being nice. And what's worse is that we, who had not met the criteria of goodness, as some people count goodness, were enabling badness. And since the goodness we think we're doing is interpreted as badness by other people, I think we've got a fundamental problem. Maybe we just need to let go of this requirement of being good altogether. If we can't agree on what's good in the first place, what good is it? And that's why I think our Micah passage for today is so important in going forward. It doesn't lay out a bunch of legalistic rules about what is good or bad. It lays out the criteria by which anything we do is to be measured. And what does the Lord require of you? To be good? No! But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Consider Micah's context. Israel had lost the essence of faith. Ritual had become an end in itself. It was all about following the rules so you could be perceived as being good. And Micah was convinced of three things. Without justice, human beings can't live together in peace. Without kindness or mercy, life is unbearable. Mercy, grace, kindness gives unconditionally. And humility, especially in relationship with anything having to do with the divine, is the only way to not become a pious jerk. Look, Jesus' whole ministry was about living out Micah's call in real life. Justice, kindness, and humility, which led to his focusing on one thing, people. He was all about seeing people's genuine needs and felt free to break rules some folks felt were at the heart of religion. Remember when Jesus got criticized for picking heads of grain to eat on the Sabbath? He said, "Rules, shmuels." That's in the Greek. The more stuffy translation is, "The Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath." Jesus' whole ministry was about challenging the very legalism many still place at the center of their spiritual lives. He was about moving beyond rigid compliance to rules to creating relationships with people. I love how biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann sums it all up with one simple recommendation. He points to Paul's teachings as the outline of an ethic that is an antidote to all the arguments over moralistic behavior. He says there are just three primary guidelines that, sadly, the church has kept secret in order to not upset anybody. They are hospitality, generosity, and no vengeance. That's it. He says, and the wonderful thing about hospitality and generosity and no vengeance is that it's not liberal and it's not conservative. Everybody can do it. We don't have to all do it the same way, but everybody can do it. And if we put our minds to practicing radical hospitality, generosity, and refraining from vengeance, there's a fair chance that most of the secondary arguments about who's on the naughty or nice list would evaporate because we wouldn't have extra energy for them. In the end, being a Christian is not primarily about projecting the image of being good by how others measure goodness. It's about taking your cue from Micah and Jesus and doing justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly with God. It's about practicing radical hospitality, generosity, and refraining from vengeance. Granted, along the way, practicing these things might just land you outside the boundaries of what some people think of as goodness. But that's okay. We've let go of being good as a criteria for being a follower of Jesus. Since Tony Campolo passed away a few weeks ago, I've been reminiscing about all the stories he told that were able to cut straight to the chase. I remember him telling one of those stories as he recalled preaching to a group of particularly pious, legalistic Christians. He said he closed by saying, "Just during the course of this service, tens of thousands of children will die from starvation while we squander resources beyond most of the world's imaginations. And most of us don't even give a damn." After pausing for effect and for people to stop squirming, he continued, "And the really sad part is that there are some here who are more upset about the pastor having said damn than about those children dying." Christians who base their whole identity on how good they are, according to a set of culturally created rules, and how fervently they believe in certain bedrock dogmas, are missing out on what Jesus actually taught. It's not about believing the right stuff. It's not even really about being good. It's about pursuing justice, loving kindness, and humbly exploring what it means to be in a relationship with the mystery of the divine. As Marcus Borg wrote, "The Christian life is not primarily about believing the right things or even being good. The Christian life is about being in relationship with God, which transforms us into more and more compassionate beings, into the likeness of Christ." Oh, and one thing I didn't tell you about our friend Haven Gillespie. The music industry has been misrepresenting him all these years. In over 200 recordings by famous singers over the years, there's only one that I found that actually records the original lyrics that Haven wrote. And that was the original Eddie Cantor version from 1934. Until I dug into it, I had never heard these words before. And when I did, my whole impression of Haven Gillespie changed. No longer a not-so-recovering alcoholic, working out his own issues, portraying Santa as some kind of overzealous morality monitor, scaring kids straight. No. In the depths of the Depression, Haven Gillespie penned a clarion call, not to be good for the sake of one's own reward, but by reminding people that really being good was about doing everything you could to care for one another. "The season is near for happiness time. How to bring cheer with every last dime. Santa Claus is coming to town. We've got to dig deep and cover the list. Gotta make sure nobody is missed. Santa Claus is coming to town." Cover the list. Nobody is missed. And finally, "Let's keep the home fires burning. Let's give without a pause. Let's prove to those less fortunate that there is a Santa Claus. Oh, the joy will be yours that wonderful day, knocking on doors and shouting hooray. Santa Claus is coming to town." Friends, being a Christian is not about being good. It's about making sure nobody is missed. Hospitality. It's about giving without pause. Generosity. And it's about that which we may need more of than just about anything these days. Healing the world. Setting aside vengeance. So this Christmas, let's not worry about watching out, crying, or pouting. All we really have to do is let go of being good. We've got so many better things to do. Merry Christmas, Haven. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.